Hi, Agnes here. You're listening to Two Queers, Five Books, a podcast that has sprouted from the soil of another podcast, Two Queers, Four Questions. Ezra and I are moving through the annual cycle of Torah readings week by week, taking turns with each parsha, wrestling with the text, dancing with it, flirting with it, arguing. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy.
Parashat Mishpatim. There's the top of the mountain, and there's the bottom of the mountain. Each and every Israelite, in this famously egalitarian way, is present at Mount Sinai. But only Moses goes to the top. Everyone hears the voice of God at first. But only Moses gets to stay with God for weeks on end, taking in the full teaching. The rest of us have to wait at the bottom of the mountain and wonder what is going on up there. The verticality is invoked again and again. Moses goes up, comes down, goes up, comes down, three times even before the Ten Commandments, and then more times after. The rest of us stand betachtit ha'har, underneath the mountain. Moses is told, Ale el Hashem, go up to God. Our parsha even explicitly mentions, Veha'am lo ya'alu imo, and the people are not to go up with him. Last week I was in the grip of some really dark days. No energy, no drive, no self-confidence. Hopeless thinking, dwelling on thoughts of disaster, suffering, pointlessness. People reached out to me and I didn't get back to them. I read the news and thought, everything's just going to get worse. I didn't want to work on the things I had previously been passionate about. My whole body was aching and I was exhausted. Another flare-up of the mysterious illness that's come and gone over the past 9 months that my doctor can't seem to figure out. And I stopped praying. It is my practice to pray at least once a day, either the morning, afternoon, or evening service. Even if I'm distracted and busy, even if it feels mechanical or burdensome. But in this place of stuckness and negativity and pain, day after day, even though I had the time, I skipped it. I just couldn't get there. Couldn't see the point of it. This mode of alienation is familiar to me. I know dark days well. I've had many different types with different levels of intensity. I don't have the kind of depression that afflicts me for weeks at a time. Mine comes and goes in a day or 3 days. Sometimes I have to claw my way out of it. Sometimes it just lifts. It's nowhere near as debilitating as the kind some friends of mine have. But the experience of it is overwhelming, sometimes shocking. Especially strange is the transition in and out of that state. Seeing the same world, my same life, through my same eyes, only a day later, and it looks utterly different. Agnes and I, researching for our podcast a while back, found this other podcast called Inward with Rabbi Joey Rosenfeld, an addiction and recovery therapist with a Chabad background and who is extremely well-versed in Hasidic literature. Reading this week's Parsha, I found myself remembering a teaching of his from around Shavuot, the holiday commemorating the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. He teaches, with reference to various classic Hasidic texts, that there is a dichotomy of two modes in which one can receive the Torah, the divine wisdom, me'al ha'har, atop the mountain, and betachtit ha'har, underneath the mountain. One is a state of transcendence and freedom, where one can experience the pure unity of God. The other, the underneath-the-mountain consciousness, is a place where one feels stuck, without illumination, weighted down by the physical, living under a shadow. A place where, quote, I don't have that idealism, I don't have that freedom to fly into states of transcendence, but rather, I feel the heaviness and the cords of connectivity of this world. And the point is that both of these places are essential modes of the human encounter with God, that both are equally necessary for the receiving of the Torah. And though the holy and pure experience that Moses is having on top of the mountain is exalted and cosmic, it is the experience of being at the bottom of the mountain and still receiving the Torah from there that really brings the fullness of all that is human in contact with all that is beyond the human. And that's the encounter that really needs to happen, that really causes God and the world to meet. And what, after all, is God saying to Moses up there on the mountain, shrouded in darkness with fire burning at the top? Well, it is our parsha, Mishpatim, civil ordinances, ordinary rules of how to deal with everyday life in human society. Penalties for property damage, for theft, for injury. You can point to various quotable statements of high-minded principle, but you can't help but be struck by the immediate abundance of detail, the this-worldliness of it all. These are apparently the first topics on God's mind when God finally instructs Moses on what to tell everyone. It's as if God, having kept silent for centuries with regard to what human beings should be doing down here on earth, is bursting with desire to be involved in our most non-godly affairs. Whenever you think the text is about to lapse into the transcendent, it always regrounds itself in the physical. People of holiness, Anshei Kodesh, you shall be to me, one verse begins, and then finishes, flesh that is torn off in the field you are not to eat. You shall throw it to the dogs. But maybe most untranscendent of all is the section that opens the parsha, the first rules given to Moses alone. It is an extended section about the laws of slave ownership. Everyone hates this part. Nothing takes you out of the experience of reading the Torah like this moment. Not only is this where the epic saga of miracles and liberation turns into a meticulous law book, but the laws are about slavery. Here God seems to permanently enshrine the practice of human beings owning other human beings, the practice that has been the source of some of the worst exploitation and human suffering in history, in memory both ancient and recent, even contemporary, its poisonous effect materially reverberating through our society, our communities, our own bodies. This is the moment where some get bored and some get sick, and either one can be your reason to walk away from this book. This is where depression sets in, where the whole thing, the whole Torah, can suddenly seem pointless, a story of liberation and mountaintop reaching that immediately puts you right back at the bottom of the mountain, crushed by its uncaring weight, right back in the grip of slavery, in the world of the domination of subordinates and the perennial invincibility of the rich. I feel that alienation from our Torah. There are sections I read and feel that not only is God no longer speaking to me, but that God is so far from this text that I feel like a fool forever listening for a holy voice between its lines. And then a day or two goes by, or a year, or 5 years, and I read it again, because that's what we do, and I see it a new way. I see a nation of escaped slaves who have just met God, waiting hungrily for a system that addresses what's happened to them. A law that is not pure idealism and transcendence of society, but takes the ordinariness and difficulty and even the trauma of life as we know it, the world as the refugees from slavery in Egypt know it, and asks that world to evolve, asks it to begin to reach towards somewhere holier, more just. It is not accidental that the law begins with laws of slavery. That is where its recipients have experienced the most pain. That is the part of them that needs healing. And the Torah comes not merely to legislate, but to heal. I make no apology for the section on the laws of slavery. I wish it were not there. But it is perhaps possible to read these laws not as a statement that slavery should continue, but that law should first deal with the parts of us that are most broken. This is law as a trauma response. You can see these rules as a disastrous capitulation to power dynamics of the ancient world. Or you can see them as a radical rebellion against them, in that they put major limits on slave ownership and grant legal rights to slaves. Either way, what amazes me is that they are the first section of laws given through Moses, and they address issues not of the leadership, but of the underclass, not triumph, but trauma. There is a story in the Talmud, Masechet Shabbat, page 88. And Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said, when Moses ascended on high to receive the Torah, the ministering angels said before the Holy Blessed One, Master of the Universe, what is one born of a woman doing here among us? The Holy Blessed One said to them, he came to receive the Torah. The angel said before him, The Torah is a hidden treasure that was concealed by you 974 generations before the creation of the world, and you seek to give it to flesh and blood? The Holy Blessed One said to Moses, provide them with an answer as to why the Torah should be given to the people. The angels want to know how it's possible that such a transcendently holy spiritual gift, the foundation of the world, could be given to mere mortals. God leaves it to a human to speak for the humans. After expressing great fear and humility and asking for encouragement and protection from God, which God grants, Moses gives his answer. Moses said before God, Master of the universe, the Torah that you are giving me, what is written in it? God said to him, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt from the house of bondage. Exodus chapter 20, verse 2. Moses said to the angels, did you descend to Egypt? Were you enslaved to Pharaoh? Why should the Torah be yours? This is not just semantic. It points to the one spiritual experience to which the most enlightened beings have no access. The experience of suffocating pain, being trapped, being subjugated in a world of limitations. Not only is that experience included in the law, it is the very beginning of the divine communication, the foundation on which our relationship with God is premised. The psychoanalyst Avgi Sakatapulu writes about traumatophilia, thinking of trauma not as something that can be transcended or left behind, but that needs to be repeatedly revisited to keep it from unconsciously controlling us. Much as we would want to think otherwise, she writes, the impact of traumatic experiences cannot be eliminated or repaired. At best, we live in their aftermath on different terms than when they were inflicted on us. Relinquishing the idea that trauma can be repaired opens paths to thinking about what subjects do with their trauma. Unquote. God brings us out of slavery to speak to us in the wilderness, and the first thing God says is to remind us of slavery, to situate the entire divine-human relationship in the wake of slavery. What does this tell us about past suffering, about building a decent society in the wake of leaving one that harmed us immeasurably? What does this ask us to do with our trauma? How can we re-encounter it in a way that allows us to live honestly with it and not to be controlled by it? One answer may be the commandment that comes toward the end of this first dispatch to Moses, a concept that is reiterated and rephrased, re-encountered dozens of times going forward throughout the Torah. A ger, an outsider, you are not to oppress. You yourselves know the life of the outsider, for you were outsiders in the land of Egypt. This is a Torah that cannot only be given to a deeply free, spiritually connected, Moses-like figure, experiencing intense closeness with God on top of a mountain, seeing beyond all obstacles. This is a Torah that is given to those in the shadow of that mountain, blocked from lofty consciousness by the limited and embodied life of human beings who feel pain. That experience, that knowledge of the life of the ger, is what allows the Torah to outlaw oppression, what allows it to be a healing gift, a world-transforming gift, allows it not to just stay up in heaven, but to touch the earthbound. The Torah is not a gift that entirely soars above and beyond the physical in a transcendent space. It is one that is received through the physical, from the bottom up, not out of reach of the worst experiences of the human condition, but incorporating those experiences. When we are in great pain, depressed or shattered or terrorized, we are underneath the mountain. The Torah was given there too. There is no other place where its healing can be felt as deeply.